All right, welcome back to the listener's commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. In this recording, we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 13, verses 53, down through chapter 14, verse 12. And once again, Matthew just follows the same pattern and style that he has been following all along. So we just wrapped up a teaching block in chapter 13, and here in 13:53, we transition out of that teaching block into another collage of stories that Matthew has gathered together for us. And that's been his pattern all along. And so the previous teaching block in chapter 13 were parables that revolved around the kingdom of God. They taught us something about the nature of the kingdom of God or something about the different ways people will respond to the kingdom of God. So now transitioning out of that teaching block as we continue Matthew's gospel about Jesus, what we get now in the next several of chapters is a collection of stories that Matthew weaves together showing various kinds of people and their different reactions or responses to Jesus and the kingdom. You have people in Nazareth, you have Herod, you have religious leaders from Jerusalem, you have local scribes and Pharisees. You have stories about the disciples and their response, both individuals like Peter or as a group. You have crowds of people. You have a foreign woman, all different kinds of people and lots of different responses to Jesus. And so that's what holds this next section together in between the last teaching block in chapter 13 and before the next teaching block in chapter 18. We get this collection of stories, and that whole collection culminates, really reaches its high point in Peter's great confession of Jesus as the Messiah in chapter 16. So in this section here, Matthew 13:53 through 14:12, we have two snapshots. And the question that holds these two snapshots together is, where did Jesus get these powers? So we pick up in 13:53, when Jesus had finished these parables. If you recall, that's kind of a standard transition line out of a teaching block that Matthew has been using. When Jesus finished saying these things, when Jesus finished this teaching, in this case, when Jesus finished these parables, he departed from there and he came to his hometown. And so wherever he was teaching at, he left there and he traveled to his own hometown. What's his hometown? We have to be sure we think really closely about this. He's been doing ministry primarily based out of Capernaum, but that's not his hometown. So when it says he came to his own hometown, it's Nazareth. And that becomes clear in what follows in this short little episode. So he came to Nazareth, his hometown, and he began teaching them in their synagogue. In the synagogue there in Nazareth, maybe on a Sabbath, he had some teaching. And the result was that they were astonished. They were amazed and said, "Where did this man acquire this wisdom and these miraculous powers?" So they're astonished, they're amazed, they look around and they're like, wow, where did he get this power? Where did he get this wisdom? And then this is how they respond. Look at verse 55. "Is this not the carpenter's son?" In other words, we know his family. We know his dad. His dad was just an ordinary carpenter, an ordinary, basically stonemason and workman among us, right? Like, isn't this just his son? Is his mother not called Mary? And his brothers, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas, and his sisters, aren't they all here with us? So where did this man acquire these things? And so as Jesus is teaching in Nazareth, his wisdom with which he teaches and the force and the insight and the authority with which he teaches, as well as his miraculous powers and abilities, they just can't put it all together. I mean, look, we know his family. We know, you know, he grew up in the house around the corner. We know his dad, we know his mom, we know his brothers, his sisters, and they are incredulous, and they can't figure it out, and they wonder, where did this man acquire these things? Now, just as an aside, take note of the fact that this passage mentions Jesus' family. Specifically, names his brothers and mentions his sisters. And this is one of those passages that helps us see the very real humanness of Jesus and the family he grew up in. He had a fairly large family. And this is also one of the passages that I think challenges the traditional Catholic understanding of Mary's perpetual virginity. Now, Catholics do have an explanation for this. I think it's a very shaky and weak explanation. And I'll link an article in the Study Hub I wrote that gives how I think we should understand Mary and Jesus' brothers and sisters. And so you can find that there. The main point here is that the people in Nazareth are just incredulous that a man who grew up in their own midst, whose very ordinary-looking family, that he could have this kind of wisdom and this miraculous ability. And so look at verse 57. And they took offense at him. The Greek word for take offense is scandalizo, and it means offense, but it really originated with the idea of like the trigger in a bait trap, and then eventually came to be used for metaphorically for things like taking offense or stumbling and that sort of idea. It highlights really their faithless response to Jesus, and it means something like to stumble over to their own demise. And so it's not just, wow, they were offended by him. It's that they stumbled over him because of their faithlessness and rejected him. And it reminds us that Jesus' miracles can point to his messianic identity, but they don't necessarily guarantee belief or reception of him. And that's the case here. They know he has miraculous powers, but they don't buy it. They don't believe it. They don't get it. And so they reject him because of their unbelief. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not dishonored except in his hometown and in his own household. Notice how Jesus, in saying this, even though it's kind of a general maxim about prophets, he's applying it to himself. And so he's assuming that he has that role of a prophet. And he's saying that in his own hometown, he's being rejected and dishonored and among his own people. And so verse 58, he did not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. And in contexts like this, that word unbelief really has the force of refusal to believe. Not that they could believe, but they just haven't yet. It's that they refuse to believe no matter what. And so Jesus didn't do many miracles because what's the point? The miracles were supposed to point to who he was and draw people to faith, but these people refused to believe. And so here in this snapshot, we see already one response to Jesus, unbelief and offense. Now, as we transition out of chapter 13 and into chapter 14, Matthew gives another snapshot. And it links with this one, the one we just completed, it links with it by virtue of the question of where did these miraculous powers and authority come from? And so look at 14:1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus and said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He himself has been raised from the dead, and that's why miraculous powers are at work in him. So notice that. That's why miraculous powers are at work in him. That's what links this with the previous one. They both go together about wondering, where did he get these miraculous abilities, these miraculous powers? And Herod's conclusion is that it must be that this is John the Baptist risen from the dead, and that has given him some sort of miraculous powers. Now, this Herod is specified as Herod the Tetrarch, and that is one of Herod the Great's sons. He ruled over Galilee and Perea. Perea is the region east of the Jordan River. So that was his domain, Galilee, and then down the east side of the Jordan River. And he ruled there from 4 BC, approximately, from the time of Herod the Great's death, to 39 AD. So he had a long rule in the area, and he's familiar with all of this. At this stage, we're actually getting somewhat late in his rule, right? He ruled till 39 AD. We're probably here around, 27, 28, 29 AD. So he may have about 10 years left of his rule. And he has, at this point, executed John the Baptist, and now he's thinking that maybe Jesus is John the Baptist back from the dead. And so we have not been told in Matthew's gospel that Herod had John the Baptist killed. So what we get in verses 3 and following is a flashback scene to what had happened to John. We last heard about John in 4:12, that he had been arrested. Well, here's how John met his end by virtue of a flashback scene here in Matthew 14. Picking up in verse 3, it says, for when Herod had John arrested, so that connects us back to 4:12, he bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip. For John had been saying to him, it's not lawful for you to have her. Let's just clarify a little bit of the historical details. Herod Antipas and Herod Philip were both sons of Herod the Great, but by two different women. And so we have Herod Antipas, and then the wife of his brother Philip is Herod Philip. And so those are the two people we're talking about there in verse 3, those two different Herods. Herodias was actually the granddaughter of Herod the Great by yet another one of his sons, Aristobulus. So we got this whole family kind of all mixed up. And so Herodias is sort of like a half-niece to both Herod Antipas and to Herod Philip. So at first, she was married to Herod Philip, but then she divorces him and marries Herod Antipas, and that's where John the Baptist comes in. John the Baptist called the marriage between Herodias and Herod Antipas illicit and inappropriate because of the way it all came down, and he called Herod out for that. And so the result of that was that Herod had John the Baptist put into prison. And here's how the story continues then, as Matthew tells it in verse 5. Although Herod wanted to put him to death, that is, put John the Baptist to death, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. We actually learn from Mark's gospel that Herod was conflicted about John. On one hand, he liked listening to John. On the other hand, he despised what John had said about him. He was afraid of the people. So Herod's a bit conflicted about John. And Matthew goes on in verse 20 to say this, for Herod was afraid of John. So he wanted to put him to death, but he feared the crowds. Yet he was also kind of afraid of John. Why? Well, this is what Matthew says, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man. And so he was afraid of John because he knew that he was sort of a holy man and he had been protecting him. And so he wanted to put him to death, but he'd been protecting him. He was afraid of the people. He's very conflicted. And when he heard him, he was very perplexed, and yet he used to enjoy listening to him. So you get this real sense of Herod's like, he's just not sure what to make of John. He likes listening to him, and yet he's confused by him. He wants to put him to death because he called him out publicly for his illicit marriage to his half-niece that he took from his half-brother, right? And so he's just very conflicted about John the Baptist. So on the personal side, he's conflicted about John the Baptist. He's also afraid of the people. And there may be some political ramifications involved in the sense of, well, if I execute him, how will the people respond? We can't have an uprising. So it's sort of a complicated mess as far as Herod goes. Well, we learn in what follows that Herodias herself also wanted to be rid of John because of what he had done. And so finally, an opportune moment came. Here's how it plays out, verse 6. Now, when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod so much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked for. Now, in Greco-Roman culture, dancing at banquets like this was actually usually reserved for hired female servants. Their role was to entertain, provide some sort of artistic and maybe even erotic diversion for the male dinner guests. And it wasn't viewed as appropriate activity for honorable women, especially not the host's own daughter. Now, it's true, the daughter of Herodias may be Herod Antipas's stepdaughter, that's possible, and maybe in his mind that was good enough, who knows, but she comes and dances, Herod likes her dance, and in a moment of having too much wine, enjoying the dance, he blurts out, ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you. So the daughter of Herodias actually goes and confers with her mom before she responds to Herod. And look at verse 8. After being prompted by her mother, that is by Herodias, she said, give me the head of John the Baptist on a platter. Obviously, Herodias wanted John the Baptist God as well. Here's an opportune moment. And so now they're in this dinner party with all of Herod's guests. She asked for John the Baptist's head on a platter. And although he was grieved, verse 9, the king commanded it to be given because of his oaths and his dinner guests. I mean, like, what is he going to do? Is he going to renege on his promise and his oath in front of all these guests and look like a man who doesn't keep his word and looks like a coward, maybe looks like he's protecting John, right? All that sort of stuff. And so he relents and just gives in and gives the command, let it be so. And so he sent word, had John beheaded in the prison. His head was brought on a platter, given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And that's how John the Baptist met his demise. we actually have a little bit of historical detail on John the Baptist and his death that is recorded by the Jewish historian Josephus. And so I will link a little summary of that in the study hub as well. But here we get the summary of how John was executed. And then what Matthew tells us is that John's disciples came and took away the body and buried it, and they went and reported to Jesus in verse 12. And that's the end of the flashback. Now, how long before this moment in Matthew's gospel did John die this way? Well, we don't really know. But in Matthew's narrative, it actually sounds like it was fairly recently. Verse 1 of chapter 14 says, "At that time," seeming to suggest this is a fairly recent thing. And the very next episode that picks up in 14:13 says, "When Jesus heard about this, he withdrew and he left." And so it seems to suggest that this was fairly recent in Jesus' ministry and life that Herod had John the Baptist killed. And so as Jesus' ministry continues to expand and his miracles are becoming well known, Herod is beginning to fear that perhaps somehow God had raised John the Baptist from the dead, and Jesus is really him, and that's why Jesus has these powers. Kind of a ridiculous assumption, it seems to us, but that's where Herod is at. And that seems to actually cause some concern for Jesus as well. At least Herod's rising tension towards Jesus, what happened to John the Baptist, the hostility, maybe the things are getting a little too hot for Jesus. And so in the very next story, we'll see how Jesus gets away and withdraws for a while to kind of, all right, we got to get out of maybe Herod's territory for a little bit. We got to get out of the cities a little bit. And he tries to get a little bit of space until things kind of calm down and cool down just a little bit. So we'll look at that beginning in the next recording. Now, as we noted at the outset, the question that holds these two snapshots together is, where did Jesus get these powers? The people in Nazareth are wondering that. Herod Antipas is wondering that. And this reminds us, I think importantly, that Jesus didn't walk around with like a holy glow or a halo over his head. Instead, he just appeared ordinary, like a typical Jewish man of the first century. In fact, Isaiah the prophet, describing the coming Messiah, said he has no stately form or majesty that we should look at him, that we should admire him, right? He just looked normal, ordinary. The Apostle Paul will say later to the Philippians that being found in appearance as a man, in other words, to all appearances, he looked just like an ordinary human being. And yet, he has this incredible authority when he teaches, and he's able to perform these miraculous powers with a frequency and in a way that no one else really has. So who is this one? Where did he get these powers? And the next section, the next story, will actually give us a glimpse. All right, thanks for tuning into this session of the Listener's Commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. The Listener's Commentary is a listener-supported, crowd-funded Bible teaching ministry that is made possible by the generous support of people just like you. So to all of you who make this ministry possible, thanks a ton, and know that God is bearing good fruit, not just in you, but in others all around the world because of your generosity. And if you have been blessed or impacted in some way by the Listener's Commentary and want to join the team of supporters, easiest way to do that is to go to listenerscommentary.com, click the Give button. It'll redirect you to a page through World Family Mission, sort of an umbrella organization for independent ministries, and you can give a one-time donation right there, or you can set up a recurring monthly donation as well. Thanks a ton for your support.